Oops.
Okay. Wow. Okay, let's get going. I'm gonna grab my snack. Good. So I'm ready and loaded.
Yeah. You're going to ask me to introduce myself and my project, and then I'm going to be awkward, right? This would be so fun.
I didn't. The funny thing is, we've been recording for like 15 minutes now.
Yeah, I know. I know what you've been doing.
Have you consented? Mm. Wait, that's something.
As in, I know you've been preparing me and easing me into it, and you've done a marvelous job. But I have been aware of it.
And the music you just heard was a creation by our guest today, which is Alyosha from the Willow Project. Throughout the episode, you might hear a few more tunes scattered here and there. And if you want to hear more, just check out their website, worm-blossom.org, which they host together with Sammy. Today we will be hearing a bit of a more, I guess Alyosha called it theoretical computer science take on these kind of protocols, and specifically a walkthrough of Willow and what makes Willow particularly secure compared to most other protocols in the scene. So with no further ado, let's dive in.
So much for joining me here today, Alyosha. We have been chatting away for a solid 20 minutes already.
Oops.
And now it's time for the official podcast. So you and I have known each other for quite a few years now.
True.
And it started in the, I want to say infamous, but it's not very infamous. It's more like famous, but it's also not famous.
It should be infamous.
And what we're talking about is, of course, Scuttlebutt. For those who have no clue what Scuttlebutt is, do you want to give a quick debrief on the Sailors Network?
Oh, no. You will get an unusual debrief on that if I'm the one to do it, but sure, I can give it a try.
Yeah.
So, in a year that might have been 2015 or something, a person in New Zealand named Dominic Tarr decided that the world needs better technology for certain things, including social networking. I mean, actually, he wanted to build a package manager, which is something I can deeply relate to, but it got derailed a bit. So Secure Scuttlebutt is this protocol by which people, or rather their computers, can exchange information in a way that is not dependent on there always being a direct internet connection available. So Dominic basically lived on a sailboat and didn't have internet for very long periods of time. Mm-hmm. But that shouldn't stop him from just writing down stuff, like in a diary, and maybe later just synchronizing it with other peers. And that's what Scuttlebutt is, essentially. You write a kind of diary of entries, and you tell your computer who your friends are, and then the data is automatically exchanged between you whenever there's connectivity. Mm-hmm. And crucially, that connectivity doesn't need to be direct. Mm-hmm. So if I wanted to see Dominic's post, I wouldn't need to connect to Dominic directly, but rather I would just need to find anyone else who already had Dominic's posts, and then I would be able to receive them and also verify that they had not been altered, that they really were what Dominic had intended.
But, like, why not just use internet, then?
Well, it works over the internet, potentially.
What's the difference? Why don't you just, like, Facebook message someone or something?
Right. Right. So it might come as a bit of a surprise, but I'm not terribly fond of Facebook, and neither was Dominic Tarr. So
why? Come on. You have actually gone quite far with that. Like, you... Do you have a smartphone?
I do.
You do?
Yes.
I've never seen you use one.
That's correct, because you've never seen me being controlled whether I have a ticket in public transport in Berlin. Because that's why I have a smartphone.
Oh, so it's kind of forced into the system aspect.
Yep.
Yeah. Makes sense. But, yeah, it touches on the whole bigger picture of things, though. And you, while we met on Scuttlebutt, you are currently working on a project called Willow, which is the next generation of these kind of networks that would work even if you're out sailing on a sailboat and you don't have access to internet but want to communicate with your friends. First of all, like, if we skip the whole, like, why of, like, okay, Facebook is horrible, surveillance state society, and all of these things.
I knew this was implicit, and I wouldn't have to say
it. Yeah, they are. Good call. But if we then dive instead straight into why Willow... Because that's not as implicit.
Fair.
Why did you start Willow when Scuttlebutt was around?
Mm-hmm. So first of all, it's difficult for me to answer that because I never sat down and said, these are the three reasons that make me want to do this thing, right? Instead, it's a whole set of feelings and drives that lead into putting the time into this. But as far as I have managed to identify like coherent concepts in what is driving me, I would say the two primary ones are the fragility of the default way of going about it and a sort of carelessness toward users, where tools can be turned against the users.
Mm.
And the fragility aspect of it, that's what we just, you know, move to the sidelines as being implicit in, you know, Facebook's bad for multiple reasons. But
so I mean, when you say fragility, if I'm translating it into my own terms, mm-hmm. just to understand, does that mean like security risks and like, or where, what do you mean with fragility?
Not necessarily security, but just we are dependent on certain information technology. Right, we treat it as infrastructure and we treat it as being there and working, and stuff starts breaking in the real world once computers start breaking, which is very wild if you consider the role that computer plays 40 years ago. Right, and this fragility, like one of the most basic aspects, of course, is just when Dominic on his boat doesn't have an internet connection, he cannot send stuff to the Facebook server, so that's not going to work. So in that sense, it's very fragile. It depends on an always available internet connection, right? But then also it's fragile at really every single part and at every single link of the chain that leads from A sending a message to B receiving a message, right? It goes through a single server. That server might be hacked. There might be government regulation that forces it to shut it down. And right, and kind of the idea of these local first peer-to-peer projects that kind of unifies the whole space, I think, is to combat that fragility and to replace it with approaches that are actually more inspired by nature, I would say, where there's a lot of like optimistically trying things out in many directions at the same time, right? Which can be as simple as optimistically replicating the data across many machines instead of just a single direct path, right? It's very natural for computer scientists to say, let's find the one shortest path and send data that way because that's the most efficient, but it's also the most fragile thing you could possibly do, right? And all the peer-to-peer projects, or most of them, are going a way that tries to avoid this fragility,
mm-hmm.
right? And in the infamous, hopefully, scuttlebutt. Especially in the early days, there was the saying of no global singletons, right? Rejecting every entity, every concept of which there would be only one and on which you would be dependent. Which is not...
I know singletons is like, because we've talked about this in previous podcasts, an example of a singleton, like, in one way one could say a centralized server, but in another way one could also say a DHT, right? Like a distributed hash table.
Exactly. Or a blockchain.
Mm.
Right. So there's kind of shades where the peer-to-peer projects position themselves along this axis of how thoroughly do you avoid global singletons. You can go pretty far. You can say there's only one internet. You shouldn't use the internet.
Mm-hmm.
You should use any kind of available network. That's a rather extreme way of taking things, but it's also kind of sensible, I would say. It makes sense to not hard code dependence on the internet into your protocol.
Yeah.
Right. And like.
And this is why Willow started?
Well, that's one side of it. But really, if all I cared about was not having global singletons, then I would still be on Scuttlebutt. Because Scuttlebutt is probably the most pure experiment in this regard that actually gained traction.
Mm.
But then the other aspect that I mentioned beyond just fragility would be, well, essentially the ability to weaponize the network, the system, the tools against its users.
And this is what you mentioned with care for people.
Yes.
Yeah. So rather than being enabling weaponization of the network against its users, you're trying to take an approach of care for people. But what does that mean in practice when you're building a protocol? Because, like, it's not like, is it more heart emojis?
Maybe you should adapt that as a strategy. You know, like, there's at least 5 differently colored heart emojis, right? So you just encode everything using different colors of the heart emoji. We might be onto something. And it's not exactly human readable, but as a human, whatever you look at, you get a good vibe.
But we are actually slightly onto something, because if one looks at your website, like Willow, and your also personal website, is it worm.blossom?
Worm-blossom.org.
Worm-blossom.org. Where you have this like expression, which is also very much thanks to your co-creator, Sammy, and she is a fantastic cartoon artist. And so the Willow Protocol.
Comic artist.
Oh, comic artist, sorry.
Sammy would yell at me if I didn't jump in here right now.
What's the difference?
You'd have to ask Sammy that.
Oh, okay.
Let's just call her an illustrator.
Okay, illustrator. Well, she's a fantastic illustrator, and like the whole Willow Protocol is very well documented, one of the best of its kind, which is something we could talk about, and we will talk about pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
But is this also part of the care you're talking about?
No, and yes.
Okay.
I don't know. Feelings are mushy things.
Okay, wait. This was actually before I slightly interrupted you by like raising my hand. And that was because you keep coming back to your feelings. And me as knowing you, you have a lot of feelings, of course, as anyone does. But your feelings are often seemingly intuitively connected to deeper thought. Because, something that the listener might not know, you are not pure developer TM. You're actually like a mathematician, right?
Well, technically no, but...
And a musician.
Well, technically no, but... Actually, no, I shouldn't do that. Yes, I self-identify as a musician.
Yeah.
And screw labels. So yes, I'm a musician, damn it.
Yes, you are.
But no, I lack the proper training. Like, I don't know enough analysis. and not enough topology to call myself a mathematician. I'm sorry.
Okay.
But yes, amongst computer scientists, I've taken a fairly theory-heavy and math-laden route. Let's phrase it like that.
Let's phrase it like that, then. But when you talk about feelings, are those feelings maybe also connected to... Okay, I'm trying to remember the terminology you just used, but like these theory-laden perspectives that you also hold?
That's a good question. Like, I've always been very guided both in which things I'm exploring and in which shape that exploration takes, by a sense of aesthetics almost. Like, seeing solutions that are not beautiful makes me want to replace them, which is both a strength and a curse in some sense. It's a strength because it leaves me dissatisfied with things that many other people who don't then develop their own protocols from scratch will just accept. Right? And I do think the problems are real that we can identify there. So it's good to have a sort of innate motivation to try to improve on things. Mm-hmm. Right, so that's how I would say it's a strength. And I guess it's a weakness in two senses. One, purely in the conventional academic / mathematical sense, that's not a valid argument.
Yeah.
Right, so communicating stuff needs a different kind of work. And two, also, sometimes reality is just messy, and I need to stop myself from considering messiness as unappealing or unaesthetic.
But I think this is also... Okay, this is a weird maybe relation to make, but there's this anime called Orb.
Never heard of it.
No, it's a quite nice anime, I would say. But the topic of the anime is about... mathematicians who started looking at, is it called the heuristic model? Like, basically that the sun is in the center and the earth is like rotating around the sun, which was like a thing only heretics would say back in the day.
Oh, is it placed in Poland?
Good question. I don't actually know where geographically it takes place, but... One of the perspectives that it keeps coming back to is like that these mathematicians that were looking at what convinced them was the truth, even though they eventually got killed for it, because they were saying something that was going against the word of God, so to speak. And they kept coming back to like the sense of beauty and cleanness. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I've never been able to relate to, because I'm not a mathematician and I haven't dove in deep into that space.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also understanding that as an artist and math, like someone who speaks the language of math, so to speak, there is a sense of innate beauty that isn't necessarily a rejection of messiness, but it can also be the beauty of nature in many ways.
I mean, I do know that being guided by a sense of beauty is fairly common amongst mathematicians. Like, I'm not the weird one out there, at least not amongst mathematicians. There's a beautiful piece of writing called Lockhart's Lament, which does a good job of conveying the beauty in mathematics to non-mathematicians. So I'll ask you to put a link to that into the description. Also, how did we get here?
Vast
tangent.
The starting point of this was how you're weaving in illustrations and weaving in your own music is available on worm/blossom.org. And you're taking this approach to your work that is rooted in care for people. And care for people is multifaceted.
Yeah, and accordingly, I can take my answer to very many different directions. Let's start with the answer that doesn't lead us immediately back to where we actually started from, but let's go somewhere completely different. Not completely different, but so the comics and the music and the playful updates are a form of self-defense. Because working on this stuff is difficult, and it takes discipline, and it takes a lot of time that you cannot put into other things. And especially if you are on a deadline due to grant work, for example, and you need to just deliver this feature because food costs money in our society, that takes its toll. And like we've reached multiple times points, or at the very least I have reached points where it became very difficult for me to actually do the work despite having obligations that we should do the work. So at some point Sammy and I sat together virtually in a call and talked about what we might do to help us with that and to bring more joy into the process. And this started with me suggesting, let's do a dev diary, which is actually a tradition we took from Scuttlebutt, where people would just post regular updates on which work they have been doing. And so we, you know, developed this concept of, let's just do weekly updates about everything we've done. And it's funny. So I proposed that, and Sammy was not amused. She didn't like the idea at all because it was adding more work, which was not the work we were supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
There were also other factors involved, but let's leave it at that. And so she took one day or 2 days of mulling it over, and then she came back to me and said, okay, we can do this, but then we have to do it right, which means making it exuberant and actually expressing stuff beyond just the updates. Right. And then it was clear from the very start that she would be drawing effectively a webcomic, and then that I would be doing background music for it. So that's where that started, and then we entered this period of just being highly motivated, and you know, we used our own build framework for generating the website, and we built that and we kept building on it, and that led into a very virtuous cycle where, like, I at least suddenly wanted to get work done so that I could post about it because it felt good, and also just having the weekly update to work toward across the week. Like, it gave you a bunch of mini deadlines, which are great for motivation. So that's how that came about. And then people seemed to like it, right? Which there was also, like, when we realized, oh, there's people reading this. This is weird. You know, and there's people interacting with us because of this. Like, we have a community. It's on Discord. For now, it's obviously going to migrate to a Willow alternative. But, you know, people were showing up there. And then we did this experiment of posting a little help wanted snippets where we'd say, hey, here's an easy task that we could do, but also someone else could do it. And people started doing these. So, yeah, the whole site just, like, this website, it's been a good thing. And it's still fun to do, and we're still dreaming up stuff we want to do with it, and then need to balance that with the reality of putting too much time into the website is also maybe a bit of an unwise decision. But yeah, so that's a huge tangent on why there's drawings and music on our weekly devlog website. But now, to come back to the other aspect of kind of care for users. I mean, it's care, and basically, like, we have a responsibility. We design protocols that we want to be used by non-technical people, right? We don't want people to use an application because it's built on top of Willow. Mm-hmm. We want people to use an application because it's a good application. Mm-hmm. And ideally, that application is built on Willow, and thus the users inherit certain benefits they're not necessarily aware of. And hopefully they will never need to be aware of them even, right? Like, it should be invisible, and I'm getting off point.
Well, actually, that's great timing of you getting off point, because I'm a little bit curious here, because you mentioned that the user would inherit some specific benefits without necessarily having to be aware of what specific benefits they're getting from using an application that's running over Willow. But I'm curious here, like, we started this conversation a bit of comparing with Scuttlebutt, but not everyone knows Scuttlebutt. So just to start off, what are, like, the benefits of having an application over Willow?
Mm-hmm.
What are the different qualities that come with that? How does it differ from, like, making a regular web application? You know what I mean?
I mean, regular web applications are fine, except they're fragile.
Mm.
Right? I think the more interesting part is once you leave all that fragile stuff behind and move into the peer-to-peer world, and then the community over the past decade or so, I mean decades, technically has done a very good job of building anti-fragile stuff, or, you know, some communities.
Are you referring the work by Taleb here, like anti-fragility stuff?
Not consciously so.
Oh, cool. Okay. Yeah,
I am roughly aware of that work.
Yeah.
But no, I just meant it's not fragile.
Yeah.
It's
an intuitive term.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, whole side tangent, loading very specific meaning, like technical meaning in a specific context, onto very intuitive terms is a great cause for miscommunication.
Yeah, that's very true.
We're staying focused. We can do this. I'm going to stay focused now.
You don't have to stay focused. So normally...
What? No? Why didn't you say so from the very start? So, this morning, breakfast.
What did you have for breakfast?
Cereals.
Oh, really?
Yes.
What type? How did they differ from other cereals?
So, why you should use Willow? Why Willow is better than everyone else?
No!
Here we go.
Okay, we actually had a conversation about this just last night because we were out at a bar.
Indeed. But our listeners don't need to know that. We can just organically replay that full conversation.
But I don't know. Like, okay, so that was slash sarcasm for anyone who didn't pick that up on Angosha's voice.
Well, I thought you were just going to edit that out, but thank you very much.
No. This is staying. 100%.
Yeah, maybe we can just edit up into two parts, like the comedy episode and the Willow episode.
Okay, insert jingle from Alyosha.
Oh, no, you meant editing. Damn it.
So, welcome back. Now we're staying focused. We sidetracked, and we're going to sidetrack into two other topics. But before we sidetrack into two other topics, we're going to continue on the thread of the qualities that are inherent of a protocol such as Willow, and maybe specifically Willow. Let's start with, like, what's protocols like Willow, which are usually, like, routing agnostic, which is a term, but basically that you could use it over Sneakernet, like put stuff on USB, or that you could put it on, route your data via mesh network or Bluetooth and bounce it between phones or the regular internet. And then we have the peer-to-peer quality. And then we also have the local first quality. And, like, Willow is, from my perspective, a very classic example of, like, a peer-for-peer application or a protocol.
Yeah, but here's what we're trying to provide beyond that.
Yeah.
We're trying very hard to enable features such as strong deletion of metadata, user agency over which stuff propagates where and how to get rid of it later.
So, number one, on a regular application, I can just delete my data. Why does it matter that you can delete your data?
Wow. Why haven't we thought of that yet? No, so here's the thing. There's several facets to the question of deletion in distributed systems. So once you put something on the internet, anyone might have it, right? Like, it might be downloaded by somebody else. And if you then delete it on your machine locally, that doesn't really help because it's still on different machines. And you can ask other people nicely to also delete their copies of the data. And if all of them comply, then yay, you deleted the thing truly. However, if somebody took a screenshot and printed it out, then no computer protocol is going to be able to, you know, break into their home and destroy that printout. So there are certain limits to which forms of deletion you can achieve. But in this peer-to-peer space, where one of the core tenets is essentially that data is stored redundantly on multiple machines, and you don't really know in advance which machines those might be, there is a very tempting way of going about deletion, which is just to give up on it. Right? You might say, well, no chance, you can't force people to delete it. It's open source, they might just modify the client to not delete stuff. So why even bother?
Mm.
Right? That's one approach. And a surprisingly large number of protocols takes that approach and makes choices in their data models. So kind of that choices that sit at the very heart of how you insert data into these systems that rely on deletion not really being a priority.
Mm.
Right? Scuttlebutt is, well, it should be infamous for many reasons. Mm. And one of them is that its core data structure, essentially, whenever you post new data, that new data contains a reference to prior data.
Mm.
And Scuttlebutt says you have to kind of check the validity of that reference. And that also includes checking the validity of, well, the thing you're referencing, that reference's thing before it as well. So you have to check that step as well. And you kind of have to step through the full chain and verify everything, which means you can't delete anything. Everything has to be always available in order to perform this sort of verification. So Scuttlebutt is inherently unable to delete stuff up to certain caveats, but...
So basically, like, on regular internet, it's difficult to get something deleted because whomever could download it. On Scuttlebutt, it was essentially an inbuilt function of the protocol to make sure that things did not get deleted.
Yes, and in Scuttlebutt, like, the data structure is called an append-only log, and more recently, there's been a lot of protocols exploring stuff like Merkle DAX, which is... roughly put, a generalization of this, where instead of having only one preceding thing you need to validate, you can have multiple things you need to validate. That's very roughly speaking what a Merkle DAG is. And yeah, all of these are very anti-deletion in some sense. And I'm not buying the argument that says, well, don't expect things to go away if you've put them on the internet. Like, just don't put things on the internet then. Well, but I do want to put things on the internet. And I get it can't be that black and white.
Mm-hmm.
So at the very least, a protocol should be able to, like, I should be able to signal intent. I would like this to be deleted.
Mm-hmm.
Because, sure, there might be malicious peers who will not respect this intent. But, you know, most human beings are kind of okay. And also, most human beings don't modify the software they run on their computer. So,
bigger part of it.
I actually think the prior is more important. But,
I think it's more important than later.
But anyway, yeah. Anyway, so if most people do honor deletion requests, so if I post something and then I later delete that, then the malicious user has to obtain the data kind of in the window.
Mm.
where it was not yet deleted, right? And that window, relative to the duration of the universe, that window is going to shrink and shrink and shrink and shrink, right? Like, even if it's been online for 2 weeks before I deleted it, or for 2 years, like, in 50 years' time, for the vast majority, it should have been deleted.
And this becomes especially important because, like, one of the use cases that we saw on Scuttlebutt was a lot of the networks where Scuttlebutt suddenly saw an uprising in downloads was, like, for example, Myanmar, when the war broke out. And that kind of, I remember, was quite worrying at the time because a lot of the qualities of Scuttlebutt is definitely not made for safe communication, because if someone eventually found out that, whoa, their communication has been compromised when they were trying to have safe communication with their peers in Myanmar, and they just could not delete anything, it became a huge security risk.
Yeah, I know at least one person who, when that happened, suddenly had to spend all their time making sure that people did not use Scuttlebutt over there.
Yeah. So being able to solve this is quite, like, deeply critical. But then Willow enables deletion? Ish. By signaling. It enables deletion in the way that you just described.
Yes, but it also attempts to do that fairly thoroughly. So here's another problem with distributed systems, or with our particular brand of distributed systems, where essentially data might take a long time to get somewhere, it might take different paths, and you don't know when which updates will arrive somewhere. So if I first say, let's use the default example from our own website. We write some data, and we give it kind of the name, I hate my boss.
Or Trump.
Sure, let's stay with our boss. Yeah. So I don't actually hate my boss, so it's easy for me to do use that example. You post a poop emoji kind of and you name that thing, I hate my boss. And later you, for mysterious reasons, regret posting that. And you might want to get rid of that. Well, you can delete the poop emoji by saying, please delete the data that I named, I hate my boss. There's a certain problem with propagating a marker saying, please delete the data I named, I hate my boss, across the network. Like, it doesn't quite suffice to convince your boss that you never hated them in the first place if on their machine they get a request, please delete, I hate my boss. Right?
And the boss is like, what?
Yeah, like, even if they never got the poop emoji, they still got the metadata that something happened somewhere. Mm. Right? And that's, for example, something that I don't know many other projects that try to solve that, but we have found a quite elegant solution there. Willow has this hierarchical approach to effectively naming the data you put in there. You can just think of it as like a path in a file system. Whenever I want to insert data into Willow, I essentially select a folder inside Willow, and that folder might live in a different folder or directory, right, until there's actually the data file. And what we can do is essentially we have something that looks like deleting a folder high up in the hierarchy. So if I post, I hate my boss, inside something called, well, posts, for example, then I could just say, please delete the posts directory. And then that is the request that gets circulated around, that kind of stays around. Right, so everyone knows I had a post directory once, which makes sense if kind of the application we're using to communicate has a post directory. But there's no trace of me having posted I hate my boss inside that directory.
So that was one of the first things that you said differentiated Willow from other similar, like, peer-for-peer protocols, aka...
I can just also give you the next thing that's on my mind as you say that.
Yes.
Because it fits well with what I just have been described, which is that we give these hierarchical names to data. So essentially, whenever you publish something, it's like placing it in a, like, at a certain place in a file system. But then that's surprisingly rather atypical. It's atypical Because many systems are built on a different kind of addressing called content addressing, where you don't assign a name that has meaning to certain data, but instead what you do is you take the data, you put it into a magic concept called a cryptographically secure hash function, mm-hmm. and what this hash function spits out is a random looking string of garbage that uniquely identifies the data, and that random looking string has been computed from the data you put into that. Mm-hmm. So if, you know, if some monkey sits at a typewriter and writes the works of Shakespeare, and at a different typewriter, a different monkey happens to also write the exact works of Shakespeare, mm-hmm. and both monkeys independently put their output through the same hash function, the short random looking identifier, which is a lot shorter than the actual works of Shakespeare, is going to look, is going to be identical for both of them. Mm. Right? And then systems use that to request data, for example. The same technology is also used in the append-only logs of Scuttlebutt or the generalization to Merkle trees. Because when I spoke earlier of new things reference old things, what that actually means is new things contain the digest of, in the case of Scuttlebutt, the previous thing, the previous message. Yeah. And, well, that's a certain problem, because suppose I was able to delete an old thing, but somebody has the new things that's still pointing to the old thing by manner of just including the digest of the old thing. Now I can confirm a guess as to what the old thing has been. Like, if I'm, like, my boss might think, well, they probably posted a poop emoji, didn't they? So they take a poop emoji and they feed it into the hash function and they get a digest. And if that digest kind of matches the thing, like the old thing, of which the new thing includes the secure digest, then they can confirm that guess. And in Scuttlebutt, you can never get rid of that because you need to keep this chain. So basically, content addressing has immediate consequences for deletion. Mm. And there's multiple ways of looking at it. So one of them is to treat this as a feature and say it's censorship resistant and you never get link rot. Right? So link rot is the concept that when you have a hyperlink on the web, so one website points to a different website, quite often that other website doesn't exist any longer and you just get,
I'm sorry, I couldn't find this.
And with these, let's call them cypherlinks because it's kind of a cute name, with these cypherlinks, that isn't really a thing, because anyone who still has that old website knows its hash and can just feed it back. So you can't really delete stuff because it doesn't even matter whether something has been created or not. Like, it doesn't matter if I posted the poop emoji. If anyone who might not have been me posted the poop emoji, it would have the same hash, right? So then that thing would be retrievable by that hash. Like, there's no direct connection to me as an entity with intent in this kind of system. And I'm not quite sure where I'm going with this.
You were going into the direction of, like, how Willow does it differently. And you
No, that's where you want me to go, because I'm using up too much time. I wasn't going there at all.
Okay, well, then I can't read your mind and I would not know where you're going.
Then let me try reading my own mind for another second. Oh, yes, I know where I was going. Link rot.
Yeah, you mentioned link rot.
Yes. So this kind of content addressing, it can be said to solve link rot, because it doesn't matter whether the server where the data originally lived goes offline, because that never mattered in the first place. All that mattered was that somebody figured out that a particular piece of data maps to a particular digest. And from that moment on, that connection has been made. And anyone who ever had the data can now answer the request for that digest. And it's not dependent on a single server, which kind of eliminates the main cause of link rot. But the problem here is, of course, you also can't deliberately induce link rot. Like, sometimes you just want your website to not be on the web anymore. Mm-hmm. So building the web on this technology, which many projects have enthusiastically tried to do in the name of censorship resistance and well, anti-fragility, actually. That has deep flaws because it robs humans of the agency to retract something. And one of the core ideas behind Willow is that we believe that there's a different way. So if we have kind of the classic way the web does it, which is links just point to a location. And by removing the data from that location, you can delete stuff, but also locations just rot away because you need to pay for them on the web. And servers run on electricity and servers grow old. So you kind of get link rot baked into the system. And then there's the opposite approach of making links really, really unrottable to the point where you can't get rid of them even if you'd wanted to. And what Willow does instead is something different. It allows people to assign meaningful names to the data, right? So I, as a user, can say, I want this poop emoji to be addressed not as the secure digest of the poop emoji, and neither I want to say, well, you need to retrieve the poop emoji from this particular server, but rather I just say, well, this poop emoji is going to be reachable under the name I hate my boss, as posted by me, where me in this sense is an entity participating in the network, which practically speaking just means some public key of a cryptographically secure signature scheme.
The standard form of identity in distributed networks, like the public and private key.
Yeah, pretty much.
Instead of a login with a password.
Right. Yeah, I think going into the details of that would actually take us off too much on the tangent.
So we will not.
Yeah, let's just assume that we know what a public key and a secret key in a signature scheme are. Right, and so this is kind of important. It's not that there's, like, on the whole world, everybody now associates I hate my boss with a poop emoji, but rather it's tied to me. But if somebody asks, well, which data did Alyosha assign to I hate my boss, then they would be getting back a poop emoji.
Yeah.
And the way this works is really just I create a record saying the name I hate my boss now maps to a poop emoji signed Alyosha. Yeah. Where instead of signing Alyosha, I actually use my secret key to generate a secure signature that anyone who knows my public key can verify as actually belonging to that, like having been produced by the person having the secret key for that public key. Boy, this is
But no one convoluted. Else would be able to reproduce that, like, signature.
Exactly. Only I am able to produce the signature.
And therefore, by trying to guess if you had posted poop emoji, even by trying to guess that you posted poop emoji or thinking that they have the answer, they wouldn't be able to replicate the exact same post because they don't have your private key.
Yeah, so nobody can pretend that I posted a poop emoji.
Yeah.
Except for me, myself. And then it's not really pretending. And so the cool thing about this is this does not rot on its own. Right, the signature is going to stay valid until the end of time. At least that's what cryptographers pretend. And that's great, and we're going to make that assumption too. Right, so if as long as the cryptographic primitive stays secure, that thing is just as durable as a content addressing thingy, right? It's just like, if I die, then in 40 years, there's still going to be kind of my signature on I hate my boss being mapped to a poop emoji. How did we end up with I don't think I've said poop emoji this often in my entire life.
No, right?
In total. Well, good thing it's just a private conversation between my good friends Emma and myself.
Yeah, and it's not an append-only log.
Yeah. So, suppose I'm deeply unhappy with that, and I want to change that poop emoji to a unicorn emoji.
Then you can.
Then I can. I just have to issue a new record saying, I, holder of the secret key for the following public key, shorthand for that, I, Alyosha, now associate the friendly pal, I hate my boss, with a unicorn emoji, or with an irony emoji. Let's just pretend there's an irony emoji. It's probably like an iron ingot, and then something. Yeah. So I can just do that. And all I really need then is to attach to these two signed records, one saying I hate my boss poop emoji and one saying I hate my boss irony emoji. All I need is a way for telling which of them is newer than the other. And then kind of everyone who gets the newer one can throw away the old one.
Mm-hmm.
And this way, we still get the ability to override stuff, to mutate data, and also effectively to delete it. Like, deletion willow is just a special case of overwriting some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get the intentional parts where you deliberately want to remove data from the web,
mm-hmm.
but you get rid of the passive link rot that is inserted into the web, depending on your point of view, either by virtue of being dependent on locations or by virtue of being dependent on capital flowing into a system.
Yeah.
And that's one of the big hypotheses that we're exploring, that this actually works and that it creates value.
So this whole concept, like, where did it start? Where does it come from?
We all designed it on our own. We had no inspiration whatsoever. We're brilliant. No. Yeah. Willow, and in particular the ideas that I just talked about, is based on a prior project called EarthStar. And EarthStar, in turn, grew out of Scuttlebutt, actually, in a sense, because there was a user on Scuttlebutt called Cinnamon, who is no longer with us, sadly. But Cinnamon, at the time, saw problems with Scuttlebutt that not many other people were talking about at the time, many of which I've talked about by now, like the perils of being unable to delete things, and kind of how structurally they're anchored in the usage of the append-only log. And Cinnamon eventually realized that Scuttlebutt cannot or should not be the future and started their own protocol, which was called EarthStar. And EarthStar was based on this idea of these signed bindings of mapping human legible names deliberately to data rather than just using content addressing. And then Sammy joined that effort actually way before me. And the way I then later joined, I caught COVID and took some aspirin and then felt very sassy. And for some reason decided to write a little document how I would do EarthStar from scratch if I could, but I would never do that, obviously. I gave it the worst possible name so that nobody could ever take it seriously, which was Soil Sun as opposed to EarthStar. So Soil Sun, which nobody should name their protocol Soil Sun.
Rather poop emoji.
I have a gift. All right. I'm special and it's okay. No,
it's very fertile.
Indeed. And Sammy, for some reason, took it seriously. And Sammy, for some reason, wanted to implement it and acquired funding and gave it a good name. So Willow actually comes from the aspirin that I took.
Oh, I didn't know this part of the story. That's beautiful.
Now you know.
Oh my gosh.
Yep.
But there is also a certain part that you brought in I assume, what did you call it?
Soil Sun.
Yeah, Soil Sun.
The tagline was a minimalistic reimagining of EarthStar.
Did you bring in, because something that you're quite well known in our circles for is like rage-based set reconciliation.
I did not, well, depending on how you would like to treat causality.
Yeah.
I did not bring in range-based set reconciliation with the Soil Sun draft. The Soil Sun draft just started out as me removing a bunch of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then as it turned into Willow, us later adding back other kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
No, range-based set reconciliation, there's a good story there, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So, back in the day, it's 2019, I think.
Yeah.
I've been active on Scuttlebutt. At one point, the strange thing happened where like a real world professor joined the network. This person joined the network, showed off some work of his, and was really cool. And you know, you stalk these people on social media, and turns out they chaired the computer networking group at the University of Basel, That professor is called Christian Juden, or CFT was the scuttlebutt handle. And stuff escalated. We ended up writing a paper. So CFT and Eric Lavoie, who later also did a postdoctoral position in Basel, and me, and Dominic Tarr himself, wrote this.
Of scuttlebutt.
Indeed. We wrote this paper on the pure scuttlebutt and actually got it published. And that was quite fun. And, you know, at one point, Eric and I got invited to Basel University, and we spent 2 days, I think, there just working on this paper and ironing out our thoughts. And through that, I got to know Christian Juden, who in 2019 then invited me to do a semester in his group as an intern, essentially. And during that semester, I set out thinking a lot about append-only logs. But what actually happened, very much inspired by postings of Cinnamon on Scuttlebutt about kind of the dangers with append-only logs, and not only the dangers, but also this inherent limitation of one thing has to come after the other, which is not great if you want to use multiple devices, because, you know, you might just post stuff on one device and on the other concurrently before they have talked to each other. You might want to, like, you probably want to be able to do that, but then the append-only log does weird things and is unhappy, and your data becomes corrupted and everyone has to reject it, and sadness. So Cinnamon and I were both exploring on Scuttlebutt notions of how to avoid that. And at the time, I was very fascinated with category theory, of all things, which is this arcane branch of mathematics. And very central to that branch of mathematics is the notion of everything, of every concept having a kind of dual concept that you get for free. Kind of, you can look at everything from two different viewpoints, but they're essentially the same, but kind of different. And I was wondering, what is the dual to the log, or rather a sequence? Because there's certain context in computer science where kind of the operation of saying first this, then that exists, and then the dual notion for that is either that or the other. The important part being that either that or the other, the order doesn't matter, right? You always choose one of them. It doesn't matter whether you placed one first or the other first. You can still choose the same thing and irrespective of how they were placed. I'm rambling. As opposed to sequencing stuff, where saying first this, then that, there's clearly a notion of one comes before the other.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering a lot about how does the logginess of secure scuttlebutt, which is all about sequencing stuff in order,
mm-hmm.
well, if the dual to that is not caring about the order and just having a collection of stuff, which we call a set in mathematics, how does that relate to each other? And then is there a nice way for efficiently reconciling the difference between two sets?
Mm-hmm.
Because we never said this here explicitly, but the main reason why Scuttlebutt uses this highly restrictive and kind of yucky append-only log is because it makes for extremely efficient and simple data synchronization.
Mm-hmm.
I just, like, if you and I meet and both of us are interested in the data that Dominic has published, then I just say, well, I have the first 200 things Dominic has published, and you say, oh, cool, but I already have 212 things. So what you then do is you just send the newest 12 things to me, and that's it. So all we really needed to exchange in order to get communication going were two numbers. Right, who has how much stuff. That's extremely cool and simple and doesn't work at all for unordered collections, so for sets. So I ended up spending most of my time in Basel trying to figure out how to do that,
mm-hmm.
like how to reconcile sets. And so I read a bunch of papers. I found this one paper that had a solution but which was ugly. We talked about how I'm driven by things not being pretty enough. And that paper, what it did essentially was it forced a certain structure on the things in the set.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than saying I inserted things in this order in the sets in the set and now that's the structure, that wouldn't work, because if you insert things in different order you still end up with the same set if you insert the same things. Right, if I first insert apple and then banana, or if I first insert banana and then apple, I still get the set containing banana and apple.
Yeah.
And so you can't really do it based on the ordering, but what you can do is you can just say, well, for any possible combination of fruits, I'm just going to define kind of a rigid structure of them, that, which could be at its simplest, kind of just sort them alphabetically, for example. Mm-hmm. For various reasons, that's not efficient to just sort them in a list, but you need to arrange them in a tree, which is a particular kind of data structure we don't really need to get into. But what they did is they built a tree whose shape depended uniquely on the contents. Then they put Merkle labels on that, which we probably don't need to go into, but if you know what a Merkle tree is, that's the core idea of theirs. They just do a structurally unique Merkle tree for every set, and then you just kind of compare the first part of each tree, the root node. Do they have the same Merkle label? If so, then you know the trees are identical. If not, then you kind of compare the left and the right child. Roughly speaking, that's the idea there. The paper being called, I don't actually know the name. We'll put the link somewhere.
And you've written a paper on this?
No, that's the thing that I found ugly.
Oh, but you've written a paper on range-based reconciliation.
Yes. So which was my take on how to do things instead, where the important part is effectively you do a very similar technique of kind of saying I compare kind of the highest point on the tree, and if they're equal, then I know that everything is equal, and if they're not, kind of look at the next lower layer in the tree and start comparing points in that layer and so on. But the core difference in my work was that I didn't mandate a particular shape of tree, but rather I would say you can use any kind of tree that stores the same sort of data, and you can still make it work somehow. And I probably shouldn't explain the details right now, that would take a while.
But if you are curious about it, then go read the paper.
No, don't read the paper. Papers are horrible. Like that paper. That paper was written so that it would make it past reviewers. You'd read the paper.
So if people are curious about it, where would you send people?
I shouldn't be stumped by this. I'm deeply saddened that I am stumped by this. So before I wrote the paper, I actually just put a little write-up on GitHub that does a lot of hand-waving, but probably is a way better entry point than the paper itself.
So I can link?
I can link to that.
Awesome.
And I can look for some other resources.
And right now, we are at time, because I'm trying to keep these compact enough that they're listenable. So is there any final note you'd like to pitch in before we close this beautiful introduction chapter? Thank you.
Songcast.